Good morning and welcome to Wanda's Picks. Today we rebroadcast our Mother's Day special from May 11th, 2012. We'll devote the first hour to a shout out to the Black Mother. The guests are asked to tell us their mother's name and the question, answer the question, is she still alive? And what do you love most about her? What lessons are you still living by? And what is she most proud of that you have done? Mothers are asked to give a shout out to themselves, too, to count their blessings on the air. And we are joined a little bit later on in the show by Jennifer Bachwal, Director of Payback, based on the Margaret Atwood visionary work, Payback, Debt and the Shadow Side of Wealth. And the film opened last year, May 18th. And we close with a conversation with Eleanor Jacobs, who plays Lena in Lorraine Hansberry's Raisin in the Sun, directed by L. Peter Callender, the artistic director of African American Shakespeare Company in San Francisco. This particular play, Lena, is a wonderful mother in literary works. And so we have a wonderful conversation with Eleanor. And I am dedicating this show to my mother, Helen Isaac Lassier, whose birthday was yesterday, January 11th. Happy birthday, Mama. And this show is in honor of her. This particular show is being rebroadcast in honor of her, because without my mother, my dear mother, I would not be here today. And I kind of like being present. So think about your mother or the women in your life that nurtured and sustained you as you listen to this wonderful, wonderful program that is being rebroadcast today. Peace and blessings. Good morning and welcome to Wanda's Picks, a Black arts and culture program of the African Sisters Media Network. wandaspicks.asmnetwork.org. Tune in Wednesdays 6 to 7 a.m. and Fridays 8 to 10 a.m. Pacific Time. This is a Black arts and culture site. We will be exploring the African diaspora via the writing, performance, both musical and theatrical, film and stage, as well as the visual arts of Africans in the diaspora and those influenced by these aesthetic forms of expression. I'm interested in the political and social ramifications of art on society, specifically movements supported by these artists and their forebears. It is my claim that the artists are the true revolutionaries, their work honest and filled with raw, unedited passion. They are true heroes. Ashe. So remember, visit us on Wednesdays 6 to 7 a.m. and Fridays 8 to 10 a.m. Pacific Time on wandaspicks.asmnnetwork.org. Good morning and welcome to Wanda's Picks. This morning on Mother's Day weekend, we are going to be joined by a variety of guests, or that's our intention, to talk about their mothers or their guardians and sort of lift them up in memory and in praise. You know, this not always an opportunity to do a shout out to one's mothers. So we are going to be joined in the studio by these great women and men who are going to sort of remember their moms and also, in some cases, talk about themselves as mothers. And we're joined in the studio by Miss Ethel Murray. Good morning. How are you? Good morning.
Good morning.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm fine. I'm so happy you could join us to talk about your mother and talk about yourself as a mother. So tell us a little bit about your mom. You mentioned to me when I spoke to you a few minutes ago that she's no longer with us.
Well, yeah, I said that. Sort of a misnomer, though. Mm-hmm. It's sort of a misnomer because, you know, a lot of folks, when mom passes away, physically you feel that she's no longer with you, but at one time in life you realize her teachings are now. what you're living by and what you're talking by. So while I no longer have that patch of dirt to claim my visit every year, I realize that she's in me. She is now what I teach to my children. My mom I have 7 siblings, and as the second oldest, my mom taught me how to help her by taking care of her children while she worked. She was a day worker, and she worked in the cannery. So some ladies that are listening that are of age may have known her. There was quite a group there. Her main thing of teaching was always tell the truth. The truth was something that, you know, man could trust you by. If you didn't tell the truth, you couldn't be trusted. And if there are any young people listening today, always remember that. The truth is your passport. My name is Ethel M. I'm a retired civil service worker. After 30 years working for the Navy, you know, you'd wonder, you know, why on earth would my heart's desire be just to care for children? I think that was implanted in me as a young person. And when I got ready to retire, or when I retired, the thing that I wanted to do was care for children. So that's what I did. I established a group home, and I cared for girls and babies, which was the most enjoyable time in my life.
What's your mother's name?
Victoria. Mm-hmm. Victoria Oden. She was a maker of things. In fact, my daughter has, who's a hairdresser, she has her products online right now.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, that's neat. So how would one find those products? I mean, how is...
Well, she...
What's the website?
You know what? I'm not remembering that titled name, mm-hmm. but it's under Kimberly Session.
Okay.
Kimberly Session.
Okay, I'll see if I can find it.
She's well known in the Bay Area.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, super. Oh, well, thank you. So you took care of how many children? You said you were a foster parent. How many children did you take care of? And then you also had children biologically. So how many children have you reared?
I've reared 6. Six children, and they're all great people, wonderful people.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. After retiring from the Navy and doing the group home run, mm-hmm. I decided to look into education. And one of my professors is Professor Sabir, our host today. She's one of my sheroes. I'm trying to adapt her ethics. Poetry and busy. I'll get it down.
Yeah. Oh, thank you, Ms. Ethel. We're also joined by Robert King, and we were joined by someone whose number I don't recognize. Who else has joined us to talk about their mom this morning?
Your Auntie Makula.
Oh, super, super. So Robert, why don't you tell us about your mom, about your guardian?
Oh, hi, Juan. How you doing?
I'm good. How are you this morning?
I'm cool. Well, I really just called, you know, to listen in, and as I pointing out yesterday, you know, I have some, you know, some other commitment, but I, you know, what can I say, you know, I can, you know, talking about my mom, you know, or the lady that raised me, she was actually my grandmother, you know, she was, the only thing I could say, one, is that she was great, but I tell you, while I thought she was great, then it wasn't until her departure, you know, she died in 58, I was about 14, 15 at the time, and it wasn't until after her demise that I really missed her. So, I, you know, all those have mothers and people who were, you know, acting like mothers to them, I think they better appreciate them while they're here because, you know, once they're gone, you know, it's you know, the feeling, you know, and the gap and that exists, you know, it's pretty vast, pretty great, you know. The gulf is huge, and so I think in terms of my mother, the person who raised me, I feel that she's still alive, a lot of times. So, I actually believe that when I say alive, I don't mean, you know, physically. I think her substance is here, you know, and mm-hmm. I think I'll always feel that, but it's nothing like the physical, you know.
Mm-hmm. What was your mom's name?
Her name, the lady that raised me was actually then my grandmother, but I called her mom, and she was mom. Her name was Alice King.
Alice King,
Yeah, her name was Alice King, and she had subsequently had 9 children of her own. One did not make it, died in childbirth, I heard, but she had 9. She raised 9 children of her own, plus she raised myself, mm-hmm. and my elder sister.
Right. Yeah. And tell our audience, you know, sort of the circumstances under which, you know, you were raised. Like, where were you born and raised, and what was it like there? You know, sort of, you know, when your grandmother Alice, what's your biological mother's name? Your grandmother.
My biological mother, name was Clara Mae King.
Uh-huh.
She was the firstborn of my mother, and in any event, you know, she passed my sister first, who was born about a year, 18 months or so before me, or maybe 2 years or so. And then I was born not, you know, long afterwards. And then she also passed me on to my grandmother, which was her mother. She was living in New Orleans at the time. And my grandmother was living in Gonzales, Louisiana. And so when I was born and when my sister was born, we both were taken to my grandmother, who subsequently, like I said, was responsible for raising us. And you must realize that this was when my grandmother, you know, accepted us. This was back during the Depression, you know. This was part of the Depression when she was raised in that area. My mother came along sometime around, you know, when it hit. And by the time I came along, you know, being a post-World War II baby, and things weren't much better. In fact, things at the time had gotten worse, especially if you lived in the South and if you was African-American, you know. Mm-hmm. And my grandmother, my mother did not have an education, never having went to school. Because during that time, it wasn't encouraged anyway for black people to go to school at that time. And so she had no schooling. And so it was hard for her. It was pretty hard. And even if she would have had, in retrospect, when you think about it, there weren't any, you know, especially during that time, even if there was some blacks who had, you know, was highly educated and highly skilled in many things, but That was a period when you was last hired at 45, and sometimes not hired at all. So it really didn't matter. So those are the time in which I grew up in. And then, like I said, I was a post-World War II baby coming along right at the end of the war, which ended in 41, and I came along right after that. Again, like I said, things wasn't that much better. And by this time, my grandmother, she moved from Gonzales and moved to New Orleans, Louisiana. And it was in New Orleans that I saw mostly my childhood. And this is where, like I said, my grandmother was here. My mother was here when she died in 58.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what lessons are you carrying, you know, from your grandmother, Alice King, with you presently? What values?
I think I inherited all of her values, you know, and plus my own, because I'm my own entity, but I definitely got a lot of fortitude, inspiration. I got a lot of, my grandmother was really a nice, caring person, and I learned humility from her. I learned a lot of things. I imagine I attribute nearly everything that I subsequently learned in life. I actually attributed to Mama. Because without her, it could not have happened. And when I say Mama, I'm speaking of, you know, not my biological mother, but Alice, you know.
Well, thank you so much, and I want to let our audience know that Robert King has a book, From the Bottom of the Heap, the autobiography of Robert Hillary King, and it's being re-released, is it going to be available this year, the reissue of the book on with an update and as well as some additional chapters?
Yes. I'm told that sometime in September, mm-hmm. but you know how that is with publishing companies, you know. But I think the book was kind of good to this publishing company, so they want to hurry up and get it done, and they probably will be on time.
Right.
And so, yeah, it's sometimes in September, mm-hmm. October, you know, but it's going to be at the latter part of the year. Actually, I talked to my publisher, editor this morning, and she's trying to get it to the publisher right now and to make sure that it's on time.
Right, yeah. And who's your publisher?
It's PM Press.
PM Press, right. And they're a Northern California press, right?
Yeah, they're in Oakland. Oakland, California, right. Ramsey, it's there in California now. PM Press was an offshoot from, I was trying to think as you talk of this other publishing company that put out a lot of books during the late 60s and early 70s and 80s and 90s, as a matter of fact. But they are an offshoot from this particular book that was, this publishing company that was well known. And Ramsey just opened up, you know, decided to just branch out a little bit. And that's what they have been doing. And they publish hundreds of books a year. Wanda? I think I lost you.
No, you didn't lose me.
Okay.
This person who I had on, she, just a second. Keep on talking.
Oh, I was finished. I really was finished.
Okay.
I just heard about it.
Just a second. Let's see if Ms. Ethel wants to add anything. Ms. Ethel, do you want to add anything?
I was hearing him talk about his grandmother. Those were the greatest people. I think I have the best grandmother in the whole world. Her name was Effie Edwards from Madera. She's wonderful. And so many grandparents stepped in for the children. And, you know, just a wonderful thing, grandparents.
Yeah.
Right. Well, thank you so much, Robert. I wanted to let everyone know that there's a really nice section in his book on his on his grandmother or mama, and his uncles and aunts who are his brothers and sisters, and really paints a portrait of America that we don't read about or know about that often. So congratulations on you know, you're having a new edition coming out very soon, you know, the end of this year, and we'll have you on again to talk about that. And and happy birthday, because you have a birthday this month. King,
what was the name of his book?
Oh, the name of the book is From the Bottom of the Heap.
Bottom of the Heap.
Yeah, From the Bottom of the Heap. And
the autobiography of Robert.
Yeah, the
Hillary
autobiography
King.
Of Robert.
Of Black Panther, Robert Hillary King, right?
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Fantastic.
So we're looking for you to write your book, Miss Ethel. So PM Presser, we gotta do some kind of book proposal. So we gotta hook you up, yeah, because you got a fantastic story. But King, I know you have to go, and but you can stay in the studio if you like. But we've been joined by another wonderful woman, Sister Makula Godwin, who's gonna do a shout out to her mom.
Yes. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning to all.
Hello.
And my shout-outs first to you, dear little Sister Wanda, because you are awesome. You're a brilliant woman, and you're willing to share your talents for the betterment and the enhancement not only of your wonderful family, to whom you're an inspiration, but to us in general, by being this media personality and this teacher. Of literature and culture. My shout out also is to my mother, Mrs. Willie Mae Carter, who is now 90.
Wow.
a widow. She has her challenges and challenges that we need to become aware of that will be facing more of our people with aging. Unfortunately, she's a victim of a dementia, a vascular dementia caused by another illness. But back in the day, my mom was such a vibrant person. She has talents that I'll never have in the kitchen. Mom had the sweet potato pies that no one else has ever been able to duplicate. She was so much into being a mother. She welcomed both the birth of myself as the oldest of her children and my brother, who's a very dedicated practicing physician here in the Bay Area, Dr. Brazel Carter. And when we got into college age, she had a serious empty nest syndrome. So she went to at that time, 40-plus years ago, all of the black foster children were wards of Juvenile Hall up here in San Francisco. So she went to get herself at least one daughter to raise as a foster mother, and came out with three children to raise. And she raised them until they were teenagers, and at that time they decided to go back to their birth family. But, you know, it was just so important to her to be a mother and to have children around and to struggle with all of their changes and be encouraging to them so that they could become productive people. And I feel that the fact that she wound up with myself and my brother, and we both strive to have a community consciousness and to get into helping professions, was a direct result of the caring that my mother had to us and for us. And, for instance, my brother, she insisted that my brother go to Lowell. He was hanging out with his hoodlum friends, and they were about to get into some problems, and she said, son, nope. You got to cut it out. I want you to go to Lowell so that you can get the best education available here in San Francisco. And that was such an inspiration to turn him around that he did succeed And did wind up going to Meharry and heeding his mother's advice. My dad was, of course, very important as well. But I think the primary influence came from, you know, having my mother's foresight in his life. And, you know, she's also encouraged me well before Chinese culture took such a hold here in San Francisco. She was getting up three times a week to make sure I got to the Chinese Cultural and Language Club that we had at Balboa High School at that time. And she was so proud. She was so proud that she helped me. Well, she made it possible for me to have piano lessons. And she worked as a maid outside of the home and then at UC. But she always put being a mother and making sure that the two of us had what we needed to become productive citizens. And as I mentioned, some of her skills and talents I'll never have. Her homemaking skills her artistry in the kitchen and her ability to crochet. She crocheted and knit, and those are things that I never mastered at all. I do have my own style of cooking because at that time, Mom would, I think she actually wanted me not to have some of the homemaking skills because she wanted me to concentrate on academics more. So I basically learned most of my cooking outside of my mother's teaching and supervision. But, you know, there was motivation, and I always look back at her as the person who really knew how to throw down. And she was actually more of a mother to my son than I was. And I have the one son who had his grandmother's influence while I was in school and in his early years. And she was a person who gave unconditional love, and she still would if she was able to, but she is at this time struggling at this phase of her life with the severe dementia. But everyone in the family, she's the oldest of nine children, and neighbors and the church members, they all still remember back in the day when Mom was such a viable, important person and such an example of motherhood for so many, as I've mentioned, both in the immediate family and in the community. And she's known at her church as Mother Carter at this time.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful, wonderful. Yeah, and I also want to mention to our audience that Sister Makula Godwin is a wonderful, she created this wonderful film. What's the name of your film that you...
A Jewel in History, the Story of Homer G. Phillips Hospital for Colored.
Right, yeah, mm-hmm. We're just looking at, you know, the legacy of the black hospitals that were... Most of them were closed because of the impact of integration on the black community.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a really wonderful film. Is it available? Can people get it?
Yes, people can get it. I have a distributor, a friend and sister, Deborah Day of A Shea by the Bay.
Yeah.
You can go on her website and order it. I am it's almost out of print because I have there was two primary editions of the film, a 53-minute version and a 90-minute version. Some people prefer the 90-minute version, and those are the ones I still have available. But at this time, I need to get more copies of the 53-minute version, so I'm jealously guarding my master copy so I can... take some time to get more duplications of the 53-minute version, but they will be available in the near future.
That's awesome. That's awesome. And Susan Makula is one of the members of the MAPA Commemoration Committee, and has been a real supporter of various endeavors and efforts on the part of Lest We Forget, and which hosts the MAPA Commemoration every year, and the series of events during MAPA Commemoration Month when we do things like, send inflatable beds and pumps and things like that to Haiti to help the women and mothers, particularly those that have suffered violence, not just the violence of man, but, the unsettling experience of earthquakes. And then now we have the period where there's like a lot of rainstorms, and the international response has been great, but the money hasn't reached the people. So Sister Makula has actually reached in her own pockets and bought, beds and sent, I think you sent 100, right, to Haiti?
I sent 50.
50, okay, right, yeah. And so anyway, whenever I call on her to help with some of my humanitarian projects, she's always right there.
And again, that comes from the influence of my parents, both my mother and my father, and the compassion that that they instilled in us as children, that we want to help. They were very active through the church, but I see the church as just an extension, the community as an extension of the compassion that should be in our churches to help others. And life is a learning experience, and We if our parents have given us at an early age the potential and the capacity to care for others, we should continue with that throughout our own lives.
Mm-hmm. Certainly.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So we're joined in the studio by Ina Sharif, who has another name. And Vaina is a healer, trained formally as an RN, but now she's doing, deeper healing work through the Asarset community. And so, Vaina, thank you so much for joining us. And so I want you to do a shout-out to your mom, tell us her name, and talk about, your work. And you can also talk about some of our other mother energy and deities, like, through the Kemetic tradition that you are, practitioner in.
I'm glad to be here, Wanda. Thank you for asking me. And first, definitely wanted to shout out to my mother, Gertrude Jackson, who turned 91 May 2nd.
Oh, wow.
And she was a registered nurse for 30-plus years. In fact, she was the first black RN in Sacramento. Mm-hmm. And I kind of got into that health and healing, seeing all the healing that she did, in her lifetime and still is doing. And she's still vibrant and cooking and just doing all these 91, but she took care of six of us. Her and my dad are still married. They've been married for like 67 years. And, have just been those examples for us, to work in the community, showing that love and that care that is just awesome to be in that family and to extended family. And, it just radiates out into the community. So that was very important. And right now with Asarset, we have a queen mother here, Odawat Ma'ata Reed, and actually tomorrow we're celebrating her birthday. We're doing a fundraiser for lymphedema, and it's going to be at Fresh Choice Restaurant at Daystair from 11 to 9 p.m. There's coupons that you can get online, and when you bring it in, Fresh Choice will give 15%. Of that ticket toward the lymphedema fund. Her son Robert has lymphedema, and, we have been involved with the Lymphedema Society and doing work with them as well. And so that's tomorrow from 11 to 9. They honor the coupon all day. And it's so important, but, you know, we wanted to celebrate her Earth Day and do a fundraiser as well. So that's very key. And in our work, too, with the SAR set, we do have Victor Samari Kao. Some people know him as Marcus Gary, who does the Qigong workshop. And that will, should be starting up again in June, so we'll keep you abreast of when that will be. And Sunday, May 20th, we've been doing the Osirian Egyptian initiation methods, and we will be having the Osirian raw initiation. We will be focusing on Heteru and Tehuti, which will be Sunday, May 20th. The time it starts at 12 p.m. to 1 p.m., and the location is 2128 East 29th Street in Oakland, and that's there by the Highland Hospital. And if you need any other information, my number is 510-228-9543, or you can call Sheikh Msamri Kau. His number is 510-253-8120. And
okay, so Baina, since you gave us all these commercials, tell us about you know, some of the mother energy. You mentioned Oshun, because everyone saw the great moon, and you mentioned and then people think about Yemenya, you know, as being, you know, wonderful, you know, mother deity. And I was wondering if you could talk about that to our audience, particularly that might not be familiar with, you know, African spirituality and African tradition.
Mm-hmm. Well, Heteru, which also she's known in Yoruba as Oshun, is the deity, or the actually the, not the deity, but the Neteru. And her energy is that moist energy, and through her energy you deal with visualization, images, and mantras, words of power. She works in the imagination, and with images, this is how people can make changes in their lives. Images have the power to arouse and channel the life force so that you be able to transcend unwanted thoughts and emotions. And when you do meditation, when you go within the meditation, you know, those images are very important, because then you have to look at what images do you hold on to every day. And, you know, people say, I don't want to do this again. I don't want this to happen. But what happens, people hold those images in their mind, and so they keep getting what they keep, you know, seeing in their mind. And Heteru is also over relationships. She deals with love, peace, and harmony. She knows how to kind of go within maybe a group and kind of bring out those different aspects of different people and bring harmony to the situation. And she's related to the planet Venus. And, you know, there's so many things, you know, as females, too. One of the Queen Mothers in New York has also a dance that's called the Heteru Healing Dance. And many women, if they, you know, do this dance every day, it's, you know, working with the female organs and doing certain movements, a lot of them have healed certain female, you know, some have fibroids, some were trying to get pregnant. Just a lot of different array of different female problems, but doing the Heteru Healing Dance has brought some wonderful results for a lot of women. And she actually had a video where people were interviewed and kind of related what type of healing had taken place through doing that Heteru Healing Dance. So Heteru is, in fact, today is her day, her colors are yellow and green, or pink and yellow if you're single, and purple and green for healing. Her number is 5, and she loves all the sweetness. She loves sweetness, the flowers, lakes and rivers are her mode of water. smile. Smiling is one of her characteristics, you know, just keep smiling and to generate that joy, because joy is key to healing and is very important not to get down, but to keep that constant joy in your life is such a powerful healing tool. So I wanted to give that part of Heather Rue. And in her picture, you see her smelling the rose, and so that rose is just, you know, taking time out in the day, you know, to smell the roses, to, you know, give thanks, to, you know, smile at people. It's just amazing sometimes you see people and just that one little smile will brighten their day and lift their spirit. And that's key for us, you know, because that's another way of just sharing with someone something so simple as a smile every day and share that joy that you have. And our people, we need this in our lives, and it's so key. And as mothers and sisters and all, you know, I just want to say keep that joy flowing, keep it flowing, and show the love, that Oshun Heteru love.
Oh, cool. Well, thank you. Thank you so much for joining us, Baina. And thank you so much, Sister Makula. And I want to thank Robert King and Miss Ethel Murray for hopefully our first annual shout-out to mothers, the black mother in particular, on the Mother's Day weekend. And happy Mother's Day to both of you, too, as well.
Well, thank you.
Happy Mother's Day to you.
Thank you.
Yes, very happy Mother's Day to you. And enjoy
you
your weekend.
Much. Oh, thank you so much. Are you taking care?
All right, you too.
Thank you.
Peace and blessings.
Peace and blessings. Right.
And here is my mother, Mrs. Helen Lassier. Good morning, Mama. How are you doing?
God bless you, darling. Peace and blessings. How are you doing?
I'm fine. You're on the air. And, so while you catch your breath and think about Grandmother Josephine Isaac, who I didn't get a chance to meet because she passed when you were 12, I want to do a shout-out to you, my dear mother. I want to thank you so much for the life that you gave me, almost 54 years ago now. Not quite 54, but almost. And all of the great lessons you taught me, which, you know, hopefully that I've shared with my two daughters. One is, you know, your generosity. I remember you always, you know, giving gifts, you know, preparing gifts for less fortunate people. You know, I remember your, you know, making pralines on Sunday morning, early in the morning. The house would smell so yummy. And then you wrap them up, the pralines, the candy, in wax paper, and we put it in a basket, and we take it to church. And I remember you, you know, sort of always, you know, sort of collecting our, you know, clothing that we didn't need anymore, had outgrown, and, you know, giving it, donating it to, you know, some charity. And even now, you know, you go out and visit the sick and the shut-in, and you know, always have a good word for others, you know. I mean, always helping other people, which I think is really wonderful. And I really admire the way that even though, you know, my father and you, you know, your ex-husband, weren't able to live together, you know, as husband and wife, you know, you still sort of lent a hand to him and tried to help him, you know, in his final days, you know, as he was battling renal failure and dialysis and glaucoma and all those things. You know, when you come to town to visit us, you visit him and, you know, give him a good word. And I think that's really, really really kind and forgiving of you, you know, considering, you know, some of the history that you all had, that, you know, you could have been bitter, you could have been angry, you could have, you know, held a grudge, but you didn't. You sort of released all that, and I'm sure that helped him heal within himself, you know, from the things that he did that he couldn't undo. You know, you know, to you personally and also within the relationship. And then I admire, you know, sort of, you know, how, you know, now, you know, you're raising a grandchild as your child, which, you know, now you could be relaxing and kicking back and, you know, you're doing the parenting thing all over again. I mean, seriously, I mean, you take Edwin to the library, you take him to his equestrian classes, I mean, you take him camping, I mean, you know, you're just like right there, and he's not an old child, he's got, you got like a lot more years to go before he's grown, like for real, and yet, you know, you're right there, you know, with Elder Lassier, your husband, you know, helping him raise, you know, his grandchild, you know, biological grandchild. So anyway, yeah, so I can go on and on, but now that I've given you a breath, you can do a shout out to your mom and to your big sister who, you know, also was like your guardian and he raised you when your mother passed.
Well, I just give God the glory and the praise, and I thank you for my diamond, which is Wanda's, her niece, Oliver, Savia. She's my diamond, always has been. She was my doll, just a childhood mother. But I thank God for her and for living to see this day where my children, my daughter, can honor me, and I'm so humbled by it because it's a mother's dream. And I thank you this morning. I thank her, thank God for her being a wonderful mother to her two children and grandmother to Brianna, and I'm thankful for her generosity because she has so much love and she always sparkles like the diamond she is. And I love you too, my darling, and I'm so happy to be your mother.
Oh, thanks, Mom. Mm-hmm. So tell me about grandmother.
Oh, Lord have mercy, I'm at the store. I didn't know too much about my mother. She passed when I was 13, and a lot of my memory of my mother has been blocked out in my memory of her. I can only remember a lot of things about her through my baby sister, Theo Gail, who tells me about her, and also my other sister, Minister Henrietta Green. But I remember your father's grandmother, Rosetta.
Yeah.
I remember her, and she's always such a sweet person, always had a beautiful smile like your daddy. She had a beautiful smile, and she was the usher at the church, her church, and she always would greet you with a smile, and she taught me how to iron your daddy's pants and how to cook things because I didn't have my mother to school me in those things, and all my sisters, they were in different places. And so I remember, I always call, you know, Mama Rosetta, and I remember her life and being around her, and she was always such a sweet person, and I thank God that our paths crossed. And you're very much like her, very much like your grandmother, Rosetta, very much so. And I'm thankful for her place in my life. Mm-hmm. And for all the other mothers, this morning in the grocery line, there was a mother that, a grandmother that couldn't pay her grocery bill this morning. She was counting a little penny. And her bill was only $18. Mm-hmm. And I was bagging my groceries. I said, oh, let me take care of it. She said, you will? I said, of course. Mm-hmm. Of course. And so she put a little change back in her purse. And I paid the money for her because it was only $18. What is $18? Just gladden the heart of a mother. Mm-hmm. And so I was just so blessed to be able to bless someone else this morning because that's my daily prayer. How can I glorify you, O God, in my life by blessing someone else? That's what it's all about. Giving of yourself, loving each other. Don't wait for one day. Do it every day. You give flowers every day. It doesn't have to be garden flowers, but words. My daughter is a great communicator. She's an English professor. Oh, Lord. So I'm always kind of watching my P's and Q's and dotting my I's because I feel, you know, my educated daughter, you know, she said, oh, mama, you know, her grammar and this and that, but she's never corrected, never in her life corrected me. She's never said anything. When she gets angry with me, she said, Mama, I got to go. But she never dishonors me in no way, and I'm so thankful to have such a wonderful daughter, and I give God the praise. Now I'm finished.
Oh, well, thank you, Mama. Well, thank you so much for joining us because you really didn't have any notice. I just called you on the phone, and you were in the grocery store, and you said, let me get to my car. So I'm happy that, you know, because I meant to call you yesterday and invite you, but I'm glad it worked out for us. So do you have anything special planned this weekend? I know you always go visit other people. Do you have any special plans today for Mother's Day weekend?
Well, I'm going to, there's one of my church mothers, sister, she's similar in age to me, but she's in a convalescent home, and yesterday I went shopping for her to get her some clothes to go to a homegoing on Tuesday of her sister, and so I'm going to go Sunday morning to the convalescent home and dress, help her to dress, and all for Mother's Day. And shopped for her all day yesterday and bought her some beautiful things. And so then I'll be going over there at 8 o'clock Sunday morning to dress her to go to church and ride on the church bus with her and see her back to the convalescent home. And also on Tuesday morning, I'll be going over to dress, shop for her dress for the home going of her sister. So it's a joy to be retired and out of the stress and be in the slow lane to where I can work full-time for God because this is my passion. Many people have passions, some for cooking, some for writing. My daughter's a great speaker. She loves to read, prolific reader. But today at 69, my passion is doing the will of God. And when I do that, I am so happy. And I'm so at peace, and I thank God for that.
Yeah. Well, I'm happy that you are happy, Mama, and doing your passion. And do you want to do a shout-out to Auntie Teeny?
Oh, my. All right. To my big sister, who, Undine Pizarro from Marrero, Louisiana. She took the place of a mother for many years for her brothers and sisters, her siblings. And she never had any children of her own, but she took us, and she raised us to the best of her ability. And I love her dearly. She's no longer here, but her spirit lives on, and the memories of what she's done in her lifetime for us. I'm so grateful. So I praise God for my sister, my big sister, Andine Pizarro, for the life she lived and for the love she gave to us.
Super. Well, thank you, Mama, for joining us, and we certainly praise the Creator for your presence, you know, me, you know, for you being in my life. I think you've been a great mother, and you know, and I think you've blessed a whole lot of other lives, like that woman this morning whose grocery you purchased. You take good care, Mama.
All right, doll. I'm going to get you later. Okay, baby.
All right, peace and blessings.
Love to all your listeners. Bye-bye now.
Bye.
Peace and blessings.
Peace and blessings. Well, that's my mother, Helen Lassier, Helen Isaac Lassier. And we're going to play a song from Sweet Honey and the Rock called Hope. They were in town this past weekend. It was so wonderful at the Zellerbach Auditorium, and the Cal Performances gave us 20 tickets, and we were able to invite women who were recently released from prison after 27 years, and that was Wanda Brown and other women who had been incarcerated for long, long periods of time. Most of them released through the California Habeas Project, which is a project that looks at sort of challenging the harsh sentences that have been levered at women who are incarcerated because of spousal abuse. And so more and more women are coming home, but Wanda Brown was the first woman coming home out of the San Francisco County, So hopefully her case will set a precedence for others that are up for review coming out of California, coming out of San Francisco County. So so anyway, here is Hope, Sweet Honey in the Rock.
If we want hope to survive in this world today,
then every day we got to pray on, if we want hope to survive in this world today. Then every day we've got to pray on, if we want hope to survive in this world today. Then every day we've got to pray on, if we want hope to survive in this world today. Then every day we've got to pray on, if we want hope to survive in this world today. Then every day we've got to pray on, if we want hope to survive in this world today. Then every day we've got to pray on, if we want hope to survive in this world today. Then every day we've got to work on, if we want hope to survive in this world today. Then every day we've got to work on, if we want hope to survive in this world today. Then every day we've got to teach on, if we want hope to survive in this world today. Then every day we've got to teach on, if we want hope to survive in this world today. Then every day we've got to fight on, if we want hope to survive in this world today. Then every day we've got to fight on, if we want hope to survive in this world today. Then every day we've got to sing on, if we want hope to survive in this world today. Then every day we've got to sing on.
Ah, that was Sweet Honey and the Rock, and that song is called Hope. And it's just such a blessing that I got a copy of this. It's Sweet Honey and the Rock, their 25th anniversary CD. And they were just so fabulous on Sunday. And they were just singing these great songs. It was as if they knew we were in the audience. You know, those of us from California Coalition for Women Prisoners and All of Us Are None and Free Battered Women. And see, what other organization is there? So the songs they were singing just really spoke to, you know, some of the issues and some of the challenges that, you know, some of the women, and including myself, had been, you know, trying to deal with. And it was just really, really great. And so my masseuse, she bought this CD because she was one of the guests. And just so happens that she was also the masseuse for Ida McCrae, a really wonderful woman who was incarcerated for her political beliefs, and she works for the San Francisco County Sheriff's Department, you know, works with the women there and doing a lot of work with sort of helping children stay in contact with their incarcerated parents through Families with a Future, a nonprofit that she started before she was working for the Sheriff's Department with the women. And so anyway, Piet gave me this CD on Monday, and I'm like, oh, this is so good. And it's like, oh, it's got that song on it. Ooh, and it's got this other song on it. It's like, oh, my goodness. So anyway, we're hoping that Majida Rahman is going to call us shortly because I have another interview with the director of this great film that I am just enjoying, that I enjoyed so much that you're going to really love. It's called Payback. And it's opening in theaters here in Northern California, San Francisco Bay Area, in San Francisco at Landmark's Lumiere Theater, and in Berkeley at the Shattuck Cinemas. And it's based on a book by best-selling author Margaret Atwood. And so it's really great. It's called Payback. And it looks at debt, but doesn't look at debt just insofar as money or wealth, but looking at, you know, sort of like the debt that we might have, you know, within our souls, and how some debt you actually can't pay off. So you really should be careful of the things you do, and sort of the trades you make, because sometimes, you know, some things are irreversible. You can ask for forgiveness, but you can't fix things. You know, we think about BP and the oil spill. You can't fix that. You know, all those lives that were lost. You know, the visible and the invisible, and the lives that are being lost, the visible and the invisible, as a result of that spill. That's going to reverberate in that region of this planet for years and years and years, you know, decades, centuries, you know, ways that we can't even imagine. So anyway, we're going to be talking to the director of that film, and I'm waiting for Majita to call, but she has not called in, and my mother seems to still be in the studio. Let's see if Mama's still there. Are you still there, Mama?
Yeah.
Oh, you're listening. Okay. Well, I'm gonna play another. I want to play another song.
Oh my goodness!
Yeah, I'm waiting for Majita to call, but I don't think she's gonna make it. We got 2 minutes, so I'm gonna play part of a song while we wait for our next guest. So keep on listening, Mama. I'm gonna put you back in the green room and play another song.
Okay.
All righty. Let's see. That was Hope. And this other one is long. We're not going to be able to play all of it, but I think it's really cool. And it's Forever Love, and that's also Sweet Honey and the Rock. Maybe I should play Greed, because that goes right into sort of what we're going to be talking about with this next guest. Let's look at Greed.
I've been thinking about how to talk about greed. I've been thinking about how to talk about greed. I've been wondering if I could sing about the greed. Trying to find a way to talk about greed. Greed is a poison rising in this land. The soul of the people twisted in its command. It moves like a virus. Is working never ever done. A creeping, choking, killing, invading everywhere. There is really no escaping greed, sneaking there. I've been thinking about how to talk about greed. I've been thinking about how to talk about greed. Trying to find a way to talk about greed. Not partial to gender or your sexual desires. All it wants is for you to want to own, to possess, and to buy. Nothing seems to stop it once it enters your soul. As you buying anything, sending out a culture, touching us all. Greed really isn't picky, it'll make anybody fall. I've been thinking about how to talk about greed. I've been thinking about how to talk about greed. I've been wondering if I could sing about greed. Trying to find a way to talk about greed. It's been around a long time since before we began. Before this was a nation, greed drove people to this land. Greed-driven men created slavery. Black men, women, and children became somebody's property. Greed is a strand in the American dream. Having more than you need is a essential theme. I've been trying to think about how to talk about greed. I've been trying to think about how to talk about greed. I've been wondering if I could sing about greed. Trying to find a way to talk about greed. Exactly what I mean. You don't really want You may wonder whether you're infected by greed. If you have to act, then this song you really need. Greed is sneaky, hard to detect in myself. I see it so clearly in everybody else. I've been trying to find a way to talk about greed. I've been trying to find a way to talk about greed. I've been wondering if I could sing about greed. Trying to find a way to talk about greed. Now I can see it in you. You can see it in me. We can see it in big corporations all throughout the government. See it in the bank. I can see it in the military. See it in the church. I can see it in my neighbor. It all shows up so clearly. You and you and your greed. I've been trying to find a way to talk about greed. I've been trying to find a way to talk about greed.
Ah, that sweet honey in the rock. Greed. And I thought that would just be a great song to play when we're talking about debt. what do you think, Jennifer?
I think that's a good. I think that's a good connection too.
Yeah, wow. I was telling our audience before you made it into the studio that your film Payback, you know, documentary on debt, based on Margaret Atwood's best-selling book by the same title, Payback, Debt, and the Shadow Side of Wealth, is just wow. It's simply fabulous. It's just, I mean, it's so perfect too, you know, that we'd be talking about this, you know, on Mother's Day weekend.
Yeah,
and we can think about, you know, our you know, mothers, the ones that gave us birth, and we can also think about our mother, the planet, right?
Well, you know what's interesting is that at the beginning of the book, she quotes somebody whose father presents him with a bill when he's, you know, in his early 20s or something, and it's a bill for everything that he has cost his dad up to that point. And it was kind of like, well, so here's the bill. This is what you owe me. And, you know, of course, our mother, the earth, and our mothers. I mean, one of the interesting things about the book, which, of course, is echoed in the film, is that debt is not money. You know, debt is, money is a symbol of exchange, and we have many symbols of exchange in our culture, and not just in our species, you know, interhuman, but with other species and as well, and the planet, of course. And when you start sort of parsing that idea of what is indebtedness, what is this relationship between the person who owes and the person who is owed, it's fascinating because it's kind of an endless discussion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it certainly is, and it really is. And I love the way you know, your film, that you you know, you have these different, you bring in these different characters, you know, into the discussion, and you go back and forth between, you know, Atwood giving a lecture, and I kept on wondering what, you know, those you know, the porcelain, you know, figurines and the coins. And it's like, oh, a pawn shop. That's brilliant.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that well, is so brilliant.
And you know what Atwood told me, which I thought was fascinating, is that the pawn shops existed before sort of pre-biblical times. So the idea of being redeemed, which is religious language, you know, redemption, and came from pawn shops rather than the other way around, which I thought was just fascinating. I mean, the idea of you take something to the pawn shop and it's only redeemed when you pay for it, when you pay back for it. And I mean, the stories in the film were, I was really trying to find real embedded stories of people living with situations of debt that would open up the very rich but very abstract ideas in the book. So none of the stories in the film are actually in the book, per se. They're interpretations of different kind of debt. So there is, you know, the workers in the tomato fields and the coalition of Immokalee workers are the brilliant farm worker-led organization that represents them. And I don't think many of us spend too much time thinking about where the tomato in our salad or the tomato in our hamburger comes from. But once you get a glimpse into that world, you can't keep yourself from making that connection. You are connected to that person. And the fact that there were, you know, real documented and prosecuted cases of slavery in the United States in the past 10 years with farm worker and migrant workers is shocking. But it also shows the debt that we owe to the people who make our food.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. And then that hearing is that with Senator Ted Kennedy. You know, where,
and Eric Schlosser.
Yeah, that's like, wow. And this is 2008, you know.
It's extraordinary. I mean, we're talking about 4 years ago, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very recently. And so, just sort of the way, you know, where, you know, you the film, you know, sort of opens with, you know, this vista, you know, of these mountains, and then we get to this feud that's in Albania, in northern Albania, and then you tell this story, you know, of that family and what happened so that this family, there's like a feud, and one family cannot go out of their house because if they do, they will get shot by the other family. And then the different views of that reality, like the interpretation of what really happened, you know, that made this feud happen. And they have such differing recollections of this.
Well, that was quite frankly part of the reason that we wanted to tell the story of these two families. I mean, when I said that there are different stories, the Coalition of Immokalee story is very much about, you know, financial debt. We live in a system that is for better or for worse, a capitalist economic system, and there's always somebody at the bottom of that system. What does it look like? Well, this is what it looks like. Those people are at the bottom of this system, and we all assent to it because we all live in it. So this is what the bottom that we are responsible for. In the case of Albania, we're talking about moral debt, where this concept of vengeance, revenge, where you the debt will not be paid unless blood is spilled, of course, is something that we, you know, maybe we're not too familiar with here. And certainly in the cities of the south in Albania, Tirana, for example, it's as, you know, sophisticated just like any other European city. But when you go into the mountains of the north, the geographic isolation creates these systems where people take justice into their own hands. And these two families had a dispute about land. One of them said one thing, one said the other, and they ended up locked in this feud that has now been going on for, you know, over 10 years, with one family being trapped inside their house. And I was it's a tragic story, mostly for the children who are in the family that is trapped. They're desperately poor. But also because I still don't know who's telling the truth in that story. And you can see how a situation like that would become intractable very quickly, where, you know, this he said, she, I said, you said, I said kind of situation, and how people get locked into these positions that they can't move from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because it's because of honor and shame. Because if, you know, the farmer whose land this neighbor was, sort of coming onto, you know, like with his fence, you know, if he assaulted the woman, you know, who was out, you know, tending the crops, then he would be ridiculed by society because he said that in their community, men do not assault women.
Oh, yeah, and it would be a terrible shame
right.
For him, yeah.
Yeah, so he could never admit to that. that he pushed her and that she had to go to the hospital and have emergency surgery to stop the bleeding. So it's like, okay, so something happened at the hospital. There's records. So, but
well,
then
you ask the question of if you're having a fight with somebody, you know, about land, is it fair to take out a gun and shoot them? You know, so then it kind of gives you the other side. And I think, you know, I think we all have this capacity inside us, the capacity for revenge.
Yeah, but then when he says that he brought out an automatic rifle, and I'm like, oh, that's so overkill.
Yeah,
rifle. What's he doing with an automatic rifle?
So, I mean, there may have been another way of settling the dispute, but that, of course, I mean, when we think about these, I think we all get into kind of feuds like this where, oh, I'm not talking to that person anymore. And this is just kind of perhaps an extension of what happens when that's taken to an extreme, and that's the extreme. There's also a story in the film about a prisoner, Paul Muhammad.
That's really beautiful. Oh, my God.
Oh, he's such a – I mean, Paul will be released from jail soon, and I've actually
just – Oh, he went back? Oh my goodness! I didn't know, because I know he would talk about how, you know, one time he was out, he went back the same day. But I thought he was not. I thought he had come to some terms around this.
No, no.
Vivivism.
When he was in jail when we interviewed him.
Oh wow! So that mushroom was in prison.
Yeah.
Oh.
So he was in jail, but he's getting his grade 12 diploma, and he's. He's coming out soon with high hopes, and we have high hopes for him as well. But his story is obviously also fascinating, because it raises the question of, there's all this talk, and particularly in our country, in Canada, where there's been a lot of quite heavy-handed prison reform by our conservative federal government. And the question is, you know, what are you doing in jail? Are you punishing somebody, or are you rehabilitating them? And if you're punishing them and they're paying their debt to society, everybody says that, you're paying your debt to society by being in jail. Well, what does that really mean? For someone like Paul Muhammad, you know, he had a terrible life growing up. And you think, well, maybe society owes Paul Muhammad a debt too, which is not to excuse his behavior, but to say that it's complex. And if you are paying a debt to society by being in jail, then when you leave jail, it should be over. You know, you should be able to get out of jail and reintegrate. And, of course, we know that that doesn't happen at all. As Conrad Black, our other person who is meditating on the justice system, because he was also in jail, he says you're permanently stigmatized afterwards. Mm-hmm. So if you don't have a chance of reintegrating, how are you going to manage? You're going to go back to the life that put you in jail in the first place.
Right. And then what's really great about having, Paul Muhammad juxtaposed with Conrad Black is that their experiences in prison were so different. My goodness. I don't know what kind of, where he was in prison, Conrad Black, but it sounds like a pretty cool place. I mean, he was talking about how he had TV, access to the internet, as many books as he wanted to read. It just sounded like, you know, like, where is this prison and what was his crime? And wow.
Well, I mean, white collar crime often results in, you're in a minimum security prison, which is you know, you have a lot of freedom there. Of course, I mean, you don't have ultimate freedom, but you do have a lot of freedom. And as he quite rightly points out, you know, there are a lot of people for whom the structure of that is much preferable to anything that they would be living with if they were outside. And it's a very complicated question, the justice question, because obviously if we are just talking about punishment, then we're going to just keep getting people coming back into the system. If we start talking about education and rehabilitation, real rehabilitation, I would say that is what leads to, you know, remorse and redemption on one level or another, and to change. And that kind of rehabilitation requires, you know, a different kind of attention than the attention of punishment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then you know, sort of continuing in that, this whole debt to society, you know, which is why people are supposedly incarcerated, so they could pay their debt to society. However, you know, that debt doesn't seem to ever be paid or never enough. And you visit the East Side Penitentiary, which is now, I guess, a museum. And the I guess the curator talks about how initially penitence is where penitentiary comes from, and people, you know, having the opportunity to reflect on what they did to get them there.
Repent. It's a penitentiary because you're meant to be penitent in it. But the Eastern State Penitentiary is a museum now, and it's a fascinating place because it's this crumbling, Gothic structure. However, as the first modern penitentiary, when it was built, as our curator says, it kind of collapsed under its own weight for two reasons. It became far too expensive to run because all of the people who were in there were in complete isolation. They were never meant to ever see any other person, so they had their own cell. They had little gardens attached to their cell so they could go outside, and their meals were put in under the door. They, even if they worked, they only worked inside their cell. There were never any communal moments, and people went crazy from the isolation. The isolation was meant to be to allow them to reflect and repent. And the other thing about that is it became incredibly expensive to run, because if you're dealing with that many different people on that level, you know, individual meals, not being able to, you know, have two or three people in a room, it costs too much, and that's one of the reasons that it failed.
Yeah, you know, California has been looking, recently at solitary confinement with the hunger strike that was instituted, or that happened at Pelican Bay because of the secured housing units, and there was a large public hearing last year at the California State Assembly hosted by the chair of the public safety welfare committee, Senator Assembly Speaker Assemblyman Mark Leno out of San Francisco, because it's in one of the experts speaking for the inhabitants of the secured housing units, he talked about the whole idea of penitentiary and penitence and how, you know, over time, you know, it was seen that this doesn't work, you know, taking people away from other human beings and isolating them was not something that made them rehabilitated them. Actually, it drove them crazy, and it was inhumane treatment. So to see this, but I never heard of Eastern State.
Well, you don't really think about it, but it's interesting because people always talk about how you work things out in relation with others. That's how you know, if you have to live with others in the world, then it makes sense that you would try to work things out or rehabilitate with others instead of in isolation. And you can't live in the world all alone, completely isolated. So is it not better to try, you know, rehabilitation in community, I guess, is so... It's an interesting question, but then you have the question, in the film also about environmental debt and when some debt cannot be paid with money. And, you know, one of the reasons that we chose to film the Gulf oil spill and to tell that story, both right when it happened and then a year afterwards to go back down and ask people, you know, how's it going? How is it a year after when people have mostly forgotten about it internationally around the world, whereas the effects are still, you know, pervasive. And the question there was, how can you even put a monetary figure on this debt? And the attempts of BP to come up with a figure, you know, $20 billion as the figure of reparation, it just seemed absolutely absurd that you could even try to, you know, talk about it in terms of money, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that that's a question that how do you measure that debt? How do you measure the debt to the species in the ocean, and how do you measure that debt to the the birds and the plants and the people who live there? I don't know. And I don't think you can do it with money.
Yeah, and it was just, you know, just it, yeah, you know, the footage of the Gulf and those poor birds covered in oil and the babies covered in oil and oh man, and just, you know, sort of the aerial shots of from, I guess, archival footage of, you know, the early fires and then the dusting or the what was that when they sprayed that stuff to make it all. Yeah, disbursement. Yeah, and then making everything, and then right before it happens, you know, your expert, is her name Cassie? Cassie, is she the person?
Cassie Mobile Calloway.
Cassie, she's the mobile baykeeper.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, and she said, you know, she was like talking to her person, her expert, and said, but whatever, you know, all costs, don't let them do the dusting, you know, the disbursement, and then the next frame. They're doing the disbursement, like, oh no, they're doing it. I mean, we know the story, of course, but we're like, it, and then it's really interesting. I'm sort of jumping around. I mean, they do the disbursement, and then, you know, the wasn't the case settled this year?
Yeah, I mean, the case was more or less. I mean, it has been settled. The figure has been determined, et cetera, et cetera. But there have also been, you know, criminal cases brought, starting to be brought against. So people are trying to figure out what actually happened, whether things were covered up, et cetera, et cetera. And it is one of those situations where you're now seeing, certainly in terms of the, you know, the shrimp fishery, et cetera, what the longer-term repercussions will be. But, you know, the longer-term repercussions we really won't know for, you know, 10, 20 years. So there are some people who believe that all of that oil is just sitting at the bottom of the ocean because it was dropped down to the bottom by the dispersant rather than, you know, skimmed and boomed and picked up from the top. And whether that was a PR move, as Casey says, a way to sort of keep it out of sight, out of mind, you know, that's open to debate, I guess. But if that oil is still on the bottom, it's not gone. it's still there.
Yeah. So tell our audience, you know, you've got other films under your belt, and your partner is he a filmmaker as well?
He is. I have been working with my husband for 20 years now, and we've made all of our films together. He's a producer, and he's the cinematographer, so everything that you see in the film.
He did it.
He shot it, and
it's a wonderful team.
Well, yeah, I mean, as we say often, we spend way too much time together because we also have children and, you know, it's this life-work balance constantly. But most people, when they go to work, at least they go into a different world than the world of their spouse. But for us, we're together all the time. In fact, I'm sitting across from him at a partner's desk right now in our office. it's a productive relationship because one of the things I realize, and I've noticed this when I work with other people, and he works with other people too sometimes, we're not always glued to each other, but you do have to schedule time to talk about things. And when you're working with, when I'm working with another cinematographer or I'm working with other people, you have to sort of sit down and say, okay, let's talk about these issues that we have to deal with in this film. Whereas with my husband, Nick DePontier, we can talk about it at any time. So we're, you know, in the car on a long drive and our kids are asleep in the back and we have a couple of hours to talk. And I think that ongoing communication about our work is really helpful in the stuff that we do together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. How do you pronounce your last name?
Beichwal.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah, I was reading, and I'm not certain where that is in the notes, of how someone gave you the book, gave you this idea, and you spent a lot of time trying to figure out after you read the book, like over a year, and then you were doing a little research into sort of the language of debt via, you know, the economics of it, before you decided not to, well, I mean, you know, decided sort of the angle you were going to take on the story. But I wonder if you could talk about, you know, these, you know, your process, because as you say, and you know, in the notes that, you know, you read and wrote for a year, you shot for a year and edited for a year. You said, I wish I could be more efficient, but I guess I haven't figured out how to do that yet. I probably won't. And then you show the film to, you know, Margaret Atwood, and I'm like, I just love her work. I'm like, oh my God, you know, The Handmaid's Tale, she could have stopped there, but she didn't.
Oh, I know.
And her poetry is so phenomenal. I mean, like, she's
she's,
my God.
She's extraordinary. I mean, you can imagine how intimidated I was adapting a book of hers. That in itself was quite terrifying. But I think I realized the book came from the National Film Board in Canada, which is a wonderful institution in our country that supports documentary and Canadian film, animation documentary. But they've really been the voice of documentary. Or strong supporter of documentary here over the years. And they got the rights to her book. And this wonderful producer there, Ravita Din, called me and said, would you be interested in this? And, of course, my first response was no, for two reasons. Why would I set myself up for the agony of trying to adapt a Margaret Atwood book, one. And two, if it's about money, I'm not the right person to do it. And when I read it and found out that it was about guilt and sin and revenge and forgiveness and environmental catastrophe and all of these things that we live with every day in our relationships, you know, that just little things, like you open a door for someone and if they don't say thank you, you're kind of miffed, you know, because they owe you that. We're governed by these patterns of exchange that I think are what make us a social and cooperative species as humans. And I think that we are more cooperative than competitive for the most part. But when I read it, and then I was hooked, but then it became this question of, well, how do I, you know, make this intelligently into a film if it may not be able to be done? And that's why it took so long. And I think that my process is a bit of a laborious one because I really feel like I have to know everything or kind of get a handle on everything before I start. So I do a lot of research. And then we often go back to places 3, 4, 5 times. So we were in Florida 4 or 5 times, and we didn't even know that the CIW was going to make an agreement with Pacific tomato growers when we started filming there. That happened during the course of that year and was a wonderful example of paying back. But it happened just because we were filming and we took a long time. And I don't think you can really, I don't think you can tell significant stories when you don't build up significant relationships. I think it's sort of crucial, especially to the kind of documentary work that we do.
Yeah, and speaking of relationships, I mean, you had like a star-studded cast of experts. Oh, my goodness. So how did you get, you know, Karen Armstrong and Patel and, yeah, talk about your experts. And it's just really cool the way you sort of wove that into the story. And I just love, you know, again, you mentioned his name was Paul Muhammad. You know, you're one of the subjects in the story of his, you know, addiction and what that led him to do, you know, like robbing this woman who was a survivor of the Holocaust. And his, like, talking about how fast he turned around, you know, what he sort of took from her house. You know, I think he smoked it up or shot it up or whatever. I don't know which direction it went in, but you know, when he bought drugs and used them, it was so fast, but sort of the resulting pain you know, it's still with that woman. You know, she doesn't feel safe in her house, but she doesn't want to leave her house because it's her community. And just that whole, you know, victim, perpetrator sort of facing each other like that in your film is just really remarkable, as well as, you know, the farm worker and the person who owns the farm, you know, them facing each other in your film was really great. And then even, you know, the two sides of the feud facing each other with this arbitrator in the middle who's with the world court. Why don't you talk about all these experts? And then the ending is so fabulous. I just love that.
Thank you.
And then Ebenezer Scrooge, we love that story.
Her idea of Scrooge is this, you know, this character who is greedy, let's say, and kind of has an epiphany. But the experts in the film, I mean, I read all of these people and follow them. Raj Patel he's such a wonderful person and so smart and so acute in his observations. He's an extraordinary writer, talker, thinker, and you know, he was the right person, obviously, to talk about issues around, well, everything, but particularly farm worker justice. And Karen Armstrong, of course, you know, one of the premier, I would say probably the best known commentator and analyst of religious life, contemporary religious life, is she's extraordinary. And I wanted these views, these people's views, to not be like they were experts pronouncing on the stories and saying, oh, this is what you should think of this. And I know people have had, we've had reactions to some of our films. Our films are, they're elliptical, not linear. They don't advance a particular argument that, you know, you start at the beginning and the whole film is about, you know, shoring up that argument. They're trying to create a space for you to think about something in a different way. So when you have, you know, one of these thinkers, William Rees, for example, who is the person who first coined the term ecological footprint, and he developed ecological footprint analysis. He's a brilliant thinker. But when he just talks about, you know, maybe capitalism has run its course, it's defunct because it's based on a notion of unlimited resources, that opens up an idea a bit. And I wanted the commentators and the thinkers in the film to do that so that we could get deeper into, you know, an exploration of what debt really is. So I really tried to have these great provocative and, thought-provoking statements interwoven with the stories and with Margaret Atwood's lecture, because this book was originally a lecture, as a way of circling around this issue and opening it up so we could think about it more. That was the idea.
Well, it's brilliant. And, yes, it is just fantastic. And, wow, I'm sure Margaret Atwood loved it, did she?
Well, that was, you can imagine how terrified I was when he showed it to her, because she really didn't see it at all, and it wasn't part of the editing process, really. And we screened it for her, and I was so relieved that she liked it, and she has been so supportive in terms of, you know, talking about it, coming with us to the Sundance Film Festival when it opened, coming with us to New York when it opened, and really being a champion of it. But I also knew that one of the advantages of taking so long to make films is that you generally have thought about every possibility. So if she had, you know, said that there was something she didn't like, I have probably already thought about that in my own head and come up with some kind of response to it. So I knew I could justify it, justify the choices that we made, but I'm very glad and relieved that she also liked it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, we think about the aphorism, pay it forward. And so, you know, you think about that in light of payback, you know, paying it forward, because that's definitely sort of, you know, in, it's included, even if unspoken, in the payback because, you know, it, it goes both ways.
You know what's interesting? Margaret talked about that. Atwood talked about that in the, we did a Q&A at Film Forum in New York, and she said, you know, I can't pay back Shakespeare because he's not alive anymore. But I owe a great debt to Shakespeare as a writer. And what I can do is pay it forward with by helping other writers, by being a mentor for other writers, by letting, by hoping that other writers are inspired by my work. And I just thought that was such a beautiful sentiment because that's exactly right. We all have people who have, and not just, you know, people and situations and environments and ecosystems that have helped us and have inspired us and encouraged us. And I think that we, by trying to paying it forward, is trying to do things that maybe that the people who helped you will not reap the benefit, but others will. Mm-hmm. That would be wonderful as a model.
Mm-hmm. Certainly, certainly. I want to let our other guests, Eleanor Jacobs, know that I have not forgotten you. yeah, I just want to thank you so much for this wonderful film and Payback, and let our audience know again that it's opening May 18th in San Francisco and simultaneously in Berkeley at
That's
the Lumiere
right.
Theater
Friday.
At Cinemas. Yes, next Friday, the day before, like on Malcolm X birthday eve, Lorraine Hansberry birthday eve, Ho Chi Minh birthday eve.
Excellent, excellent. Well, and I think I'm doing a couple of Skype Q&As, so at the theater. So I hope people get
wonderful.
Out to see it.
Oh, that's great. Oh, that'd be so cool. Yeah, that'd be great. Because I was going to ask you where you're going to be visiting us, but this is just really a remarkable. Remarkable document, and I want to thank you so much because my family's in the Gulf. I'm from New Orleans, and so, you know, as many ways that we can keep this story in the public eye and keep, you know, the energy, you know, the positive energy going toward that region, and as many people that can go and help with the cleanup and, you know, press our legislators to not let this company get away with this. You know, the better.
And tougher regulations for offshore drilling, et cetera. I mean, go to mobilebaykeeper.com if you're interested in finding out more about what Casey and her group do of water keepers. They're extraordinary, and they're fighting for that that area. But you're right. We have to keep on about it. We can't forget.
Right, yeah. And as I mentioned, you know, before you came on the air, you know, we just have to be careful. And we need to sort of monitor our responses to things. You know, we need to be more proactive as opposed to reactive because, you know, you can mess up and not be able to mend it. I mean, this guy in northern Albania is singing about, reconciliation. But the guy in the bar who shows us all the places where the bullet went, he's not feeling that. It's like, no, we're not going to the law. We're gonna shoot your butt if you show up. So, no, forever and ever. You're not ever going back to your farm, no matter how lovely that was.
I know. No, it's a terrible situation.
Yeah,
anyway.
Yeah.
Well,
thank you again.
Thank you so much for having me.
Sure, and happy Mother's Day.
Oh, yes. Happy Mother's Day to you.
All right, peace and blessings.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Hi, Eleanor. How are you?
Fine. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you so much for hanging in there. Eleanor Jacobs is going to be portraying Lena Younger in the African-American Shakespeare Company's production of Raisin in the Sun, Lorraine Hansberry's. I don't know. It might not be the most well-known, but I think it could be. I don't have any statistics on that, but people think Lorraine Hansberry think. You know, Raisin in the Sun,
for sure.
And you are playing the mama. You're playing the big mama.
I'm thrilled to be doing so. Just so grateful to be doing so.
Yeah, so why don't you tell our audience about Lena Younger and this family that's in Chicago and trying to make do when, you know, the you know, the head of the household, the father, you
right.
know, he passes away, and I think sounds like the man worked himself to death.
He did. He did. They were poor and black and in Chicago and struggling. This was in the early 50s, and they were struggling to just make it day to day, but they had a wonderful sense of family between Lena and her husband, and they passed this on to the children. And that, I think, is the strength of it. There was just an innate understanding of the importance of family and staying together. And at the same time, and I think this is, it's just my opinion, one of the reasons the play is so well known and beloved is because there is this theme of even though you love each other and you're committed to each other, there is lack of understanding that causes friction and tension and negativity among you, even as a family. Even as strong as your love is, there is still the growing and the learning and the pain of living together and trying to understand each other. And I just think that that's, a lot of people can relate to that. And that is, in my opinion, one of the reasons why the play is still alive and still beloved today.
Right.
Lena is a single mom.
Yeah.
She had a strong husband, and he worked and worked and worked himself to death, as she says in the play. And now it's on her. She has it all on her shoulders to keep it together, to keep her children moving forward in a positive way. And it's a lot. It's really a lot on her shoulders. And so she is constantly aware of her need to be strong for her family.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The family, you know, they're all staying in this apartment. You don't see many black families like that any longer. People are more spread out, but in this
right.
particular family, the grandmother's, the, you know, Lena Younger,
right,
she's there, and her son, you know, Walter Lee Younger, he's in that house with his
wife
and
child
and son. So they've
right.
got like three generations.
Three generations.
And his sister, his kid
right.
sister is there, Ruth. No, Ruth is his sister, the
Ruth
daughter-in-law.
Ruth is his wife, right.
His
Benita
wife.
Is his sister.
Yeah, Benita. Uh-huh. Yeah, Benita. She's a real, you know.
She's a trip.
Yeah. She's in college and learning about her African heritage.
And she is so different. You know, the way she sees the world is so different from the way her mother saw the world and grew up looking at the world. So there is the pain of the mother trying to understand how her daughter sees the world. And it's very painful for her because she would like for her daughter to be her little baby, you know, and just be nice and be kind. And Benita has her own mind, and she has expanded her view by going to school and interacting, and she is very strong-willed. I think she is as strong-willed as her mom. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, I think if anyone is you know, sort of like the arbitrator or trying to like keep the peace, it must be Ruth.
Right. And Ruth.
Ruth
is so strong and so quietly. Her strength is just always flowing, and she really has an understanding, I think, in some ways, of where they are, where Walter Lee is, and where Benita is, that is greater than Lena's understanding. I think she is trying to help Lena. She's trying to keep the peace, and she's trying to help Lena grow and understand as well. And it's hard. And she's even-keeled and strong and caring. You know, her whole presence is caring and nurturing. And
yeah.
she really wants everybody to be nice and to get along. And
she does. She really does. Yeah, and she puts up with a lot. You know, she keeps a lot in to sort of be the arbiter, try to keep peace in the house because it's too tiny. The space is too small for there not to be kindness and love between the various members of the
right.
family, because there's nowhere to go to get away.
Right, there
like,
isn't. And so that causes an that causes even more need
mm-hmm.
for the peace that she tries to bring. And they're volatile. I mean, Mama, she will go so far, and then she's just going to not take it anymore, you
mm-hmm.
see. And there's a scene where she expresses that to Benita.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, these days we look back, you know, and say, wow.
Yeah.
And but Ruth, she just stays even-keeled and strong, even though she's hurting inside
mm-hmm.
at times. And I think she is the balance in the household.
Yeah, a lot of themes come up in this play. When was it written?
In the early, well, it was written in the early 50s.
Okay.
If I'm not mistaken.
Mm-hmm.
And it was produced in the early 50s.
Yeah, okay.
And it was a phenomena, as I understand it, at the time it was produced, because to have this young black woman playwright
mm-hmm.
produce such a play was really a phenomena in the theater world.
Yeah, did she, is this the one she got, like, did Lorraine Hansberry get one of the first awards?
I think she did. I'm not certain of exactly what the award was, but I know the critical praise was just inordinate. This play just riveted the theater world, and some of the best known and respected critics were just boiled over and just had nothing but praise for her. They were just amazed that when they realized that this young woman could produce such a play.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was reading, just looked it up, and it says it premiered on Broadway on March 11, 1959.
Uh-huh.
And it says, waiting for the curtain to rise on opening night, Hansberry and producer Philip Rose did not expect the play to be a success, but already received mixed reviews from a preview audience the night before. And though it received popular and critical acclaim, reviewers argued about whether the play was universal or particular to the African-American experience. The New York Drama Critics Circle named it the best play of 1959, and
uh-huh.
it ran for nearly 2 years and was produced on tour.
Uh-huh.
And it was the first play written by a black woman to be produced on Broadway, as well as the first play with a black director, Lloyd Richards, on Broadway.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and it's like, wow, Sidney Poitier was in the play, Claudia McNeil was in the play. They both got Best Actor, Best Actress, and Best Director was Lloyd Richards. It's like, wow, that's
so
brutal.
It was a smash.
It was a total
a smash hit.
And then they made the film, you know, just 2 years
yeah.
later.
Right, right. And that was well received as well.
Yeah, it sure was. And then so well received, you know, they did it again with Felicia Rashad and Sean Combs, right?
Right. Now, I haven't
yeah.
seen that, but I know it won high praise as well
mm-hmm.
in awards.
Yeah, yeah. And there was a revival on Broadway in 2004 with Sean Combs and
oh,
Felicia Rashad, and that led to the movie in 2008,
uh-huh.
the TV film. Yeah. So talk about you know, Lena Mama, and, you know, her husband dies, and she's got, you know, these headstrong children, her son,
right.
Walter Lee.
Right, and her son, he is ambitious, and he describes himself as a volcano. He works as a chauffeur,
mm-hmm.
and that just chafes him, you know. He doesn't like that. He has big ideas. He's exposed to the business world through his job, the person he works for, and so he gets to see and be in the environment where business deals are being made and decisions are being made, and he sees this, and of course he's not able to participate. He's just observing. But within himself, he feels that he is just as qualified, and, you know, he should be able to be doing that instead of to be doing, you know, what he's doing. And so he's all wound up. And he describes himself as a volcano. He has all these dreams and these ideas, and he wants them to go forward and flower, and he's just stymied. And then there is this insurance money that's coming, life insurance money that's coming, and he is seeing this as his opportunity to do something, to break out of this you know, prison that he sees himself in, and he has ideas about what he wants to do with this, and the Lena does not agree at all and does not understand, and in no way is she going to allow this money to be used in the way that Walter wants it to be used. So there is just tension, and Walter lashes out, and Lena stands her ground, and so it's that kind of situation. It's mm-hmm. volatile. Absolutely volatile.
That's putting it lightly.
Yeah.
Yeah. So when one thinks about Walter Lee, talks about himself, where he compares himself to a volcano, you think about the title, Raging in the Sun, and that comes from Langston Hughes' poem. What's the Langston Hughes poem called?
It's about the dream deferred.
Yeah, dream deferred, mm-hmm. right. And then in the end, it's like, do you know that poem? Could you give
it? I don't know it verbatim, but I've certainly read it and enjoyed it over the years. And I know that the play, the title of the play and the inspiration comes from that poem.
Yeah, because what happens if you have a dream deferred,
right.
it explodes.
Right.
Yeah, and that's the line. Let me find it and
wonderful.
Yeah, so what happens to a dream deferred? Does it dry up like a raisin in the sun, or fester like a sore and then run? Does it stink like rotten meat, or crust and sugar over like a syrupy sweet? Maybe it just sags like a heavy load, or does it explode?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and then you have, volcanoes, mountains.
Right.
What do they do? They explode.
They explode.
Yeah, and everyone who's nearby feels, what happens after that.
Right.
The rocks hit you in the head.
Right.
The
Nobody
lava burns on you under the feet. Nobody is untouched.
Nobody
so,
is untouched.
Yeah, so we don't want Walter Younger to explode.
No. And Lena is using her strength. Mm-hmm. She stands toe-to-toe with him. And she stands on her right to see her vision of the world and her right to make the decisions about what she thinks is best for the family. And she knows that he doesn't agree, and it's totally opposed to what he's thinking. But she is not going to buckle. She is not going to buckle. She has in her mind what she thinks is best for the family, and she's moving forward that way. And it saddens her. It makes her sad. For sure, it hurts her inside that he doesn't agree, but she is determined. And
right.
she feels she has to be because her husband is not there, and she knows and feels what he would think and do about the situation.
Right, yeah, because she loves Walter Lee, and she loves Benita, and she loves her grandson, as
right.
well as his mother, Ruth, and she wants to try to do what's best for all of them with this little bit of money,
right.
which is not the father. It's
right.
He worked himself to death, so it's like blood money.
Right.
It's like
blood money.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And she, my sense of it is that she and Walter Lee were really, really close and really loved each other,
mm-hmm.
and she misses that on a daily basis. And yet she has to put that aside and just be strong, be strong.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what is it with this black woman strength thing?
Well,
it's funny character.
Because I was thinking about that, and, uh-huh. I'm a woman of a certain age, and I've, heard a lot of debate back and forth. But my grandmother was one of those strong matriarchs and so forth, and so I think we wanted to keep our families, the black women, keep them alive, number one, was just a basic thing, particularly with the history of slavery and the segregation and all that the black people have gone through in this country. Sometimes it was the mother and that woman who's strong woman that actually kept people alive, kept the children alive, kept the family alive, because the threat were real. I mean, life and death threats were real. And in the era that Lena came from, she remembers lynching and those things that happened to black people. So I think the women, the strength came about of necessity in many situations to just keep your children alive, keep your family alive. And then as the years went by, it was to constantly be looking forward, constantly be looking at what is more positive, what is more positive, where can we go, where can we grow, where can we, you know, begin to live life to the fullest. So, again, you know, it may not have been a matter of life and death as it had been in you know, in the past, but it was still a matter of life and death into ensuring that the path is positive and we're moving forward, forward, forward.
Yeah. Well, you could think about it. I mean, it was a matter of life and death because with Lorraine Hansberry, you know, the Lorraine Vivian Hansberry, the third, mm-hmm. she was born May 19, 1930, and she departed from this life on this planet in the form that we know, you know,
right.
such, January 12, 1965.
Right.
You know, her father, he was a real estate developer and broker, and the family moved around Chicago, integrating the various neighborhoods.
Uh-huh.
And you remember the story where someone planted a bomb in their house threw a bomb through their window or threw a bottle through the window, and she had just been sitting there, and she would have still been sitting in that window because they didn't
right.
want her living in that neighborhood. They would burn crosses on their lawns and things. She would have been hit by that bottle if she would have
right.
been sitting there.
She was very aware, mm-hmm. and to be
yeah.
able to put it into this story, I'm constantly in awe, you know, as you read it, working in the play, and there's just nothing but awe that this young woman, because that's young, she was only 35 when she passed, that is young to be able to put all of those experiences together and weave the tapestry of this
right.
story.
Yeah, well, let the audience know that the African American Shakespeare Company is actually, you know, this play, it closes their wonderful season, and this particular play directed by artistic director L. Peter Callender, it opens on the 12th, which is Saturday the 12th, and it continues through the 27th of May at the African American Art and Culture Complex in the Iberia Clay Theater. I do not have the contact information right in front of me. Do you happen to have it in front of you? Hello?
Well, I can give you Erica's number, and she would have all of that. It would be
oh,
able to
no,
get it.
Oh, no, we don't want to give Erica's number, so I'm looking for it. Oh, here it is. The Barry Lake Theater is located at 762 Fulton Street at Webster in San Francisco. Tickets are $10 to $35, and information is area code, 1-800-838-3006, or you can visit African-AmericanShakes.org for all the information and for tickets. Again, that's the 12th, May 12th through the 27th, at African American Shakespeare Company, which has its theater in the Barrio Clay Theater at the African American Art and Culture Complex, 762 Fulton Street at Webster. Okay, just wanted to make sure we did that before.
Thank you, thank you.
Yeah. So, tell us about your background. How did you come to this wonderful character? And tell us about the ensemble. I'm sure it's just really fabulous. I was looking at some of the names I recognized. I'm like, ooh, this is going to be so good.
Right. Well, L. Peter Callender, number one, is amazing. Mm-hmm. He is amazing. And talk about Volcano. You know, just any session with him to me is like a master class.
Nice.
In acting.
Yeah.
And he's a renowned director and an actor.
Mm-hmm.
So that, to me, we have an enhanced opportunity here. And that's why I say I'm so grateful for this opportunity. And I've been acting since grade school and still, and then I do other things to pay my bills. But this is where my heart has always been. And I had always acted in grade school and high school and community theater, and then did not do anything for more than 25 years.
Oh, wow.
And I was raising my family and building a career and so forth, and then went back about 5 years ago and started taking classes again and acting and auditioning, and started actually acting in productions again in the African American Shakespeare Company. I've been in three productions there.
Okay.
And so I was in Cinderella. I was Grandma on Cinderella.
Okay. You were great.
And I did that twice, and then I was Cleante in Tartuffe, their production of Tartuffe.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was Dr. Pinch in Comedy of Errors.
Okay.
So I really just felt that it was home, you know, and what a wonderful opportunity to be able to work in with this company that was founded by a young Black woman, Sherry Young.
Mm-hmm.
And so to be able to be in this production of Raisin in the Sun is, like, awesome to me. Mm-hmm. I'm just awed. And the cast, Wanda, the cast, it's sometimes I'm sitting watching in rehearsal and my mouth is literally open. My mouth just falls open at the level of talent that is that L. Peter has arrayed here. It's just amazing. It's just amazing. It's like Lorraine herself could not have done any better with putting together this group of people to do this play that L. Peter has done, the way he's done this. And it's just, I just feel it's a wonderful opportunity.
Right, yeah. Well, let's mention some of the cast, just in case we have some listeners that might know them. We've got Kagan Wethington. He plays George Merkinson. And then we've got, I think, George. Is George the representative for the association that is trying
That's
to
That's Mr. Linder.
Linder, okay.
I think his name is Carl Linder.
Carl Linder, okay. So is George one of... Walter's friends?
George is Benita's boyfriend, one of the young men that she goes out with.
Oh, okay, all right. Yeah, and then the other one is Joseph Asagai, right, played by Eric Banks.
Right. He is the young African man who is in love with Benita.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. And then we've got Ruth Younger is played
and
by Leontine Bele. Bung.
Right.
Yeah. And then we've got Carl Linder, who we mentioned. He is the person who's with the Tennis Association.
And that's Lance Huntley. Is
right,
Huntley.
Yeah. And that's because one of the things that your character has a balance is, okay, we've got these dreams, and we don't want anything to explode. So how do we balance this out? We have a finite... you know, amount of money, and
right.
And nothing this big of a sum is coming. So we want to, like, she wants to put a little bit, you know, aside for the grandchild.
Right, for Benita.
Yeah, well, for Benita, his daughter.
For the grandchild, for sure, but for Benita's, because Benita, who's played
Benita
by Ciara Harris,
yeah.
She wants to be a doctor.
Right.
So she really wants to push out. And then Walter, who's played by Todd Risby, he has his own dream for this money. So
right.
That's where the clash comes in.
Yeah.
And Lena does say, she's very adamant that, yes, there will be some part of this money put aside for Benita's schooling.
Mm-hmm.
So she is adamant about that.
Right, yeah. And then we have two children that are playing the Travis Younger character, and we have Zion Richardson is one, and
right.
Davion Green is the other. So
right. And
all
they're just phenomenal. They are fantastic actors,
mm-hmm.
and it's a pleasure to work with them.
Right.
An honor to work with them, really, to
mm-hmm.
see these young actors. And they're nine. I think their ages are 8 and 9.
Okay. Nice, yeah. And then another one of Walter's friends is played by the friend Bobo is played
right.
by B. Chico Perdiman.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I know his work.
He is
yeah,
wonderful.
So it's and I don't know. Did we mention Ciara Harris who plays Benita?
Yes,
okay.
Ciara Harris is
yeah.
Benita.
Right, and then you, the mother. You know I just really like how your character sort of. Tries to find a place that she can allow her son to be the man that he
right.
wants to be, and you know, and sort of loosen whatever strings or
right.
whatever
right.
was holding him back.
The apron
that,
strings, right?
Yeah, exactly. So that
uh-huh.
he could come into the fullness of who he is, because maybe prior to that, this challenge, you know, or this legacy that his father left for him, you know, he wasn't really being a man. You know, maybe he was, you know, almost a man, but not quite there yet.
Right.
And so now here's the opportunity
Nina
for him to step
very,
into it.
You know, she was one of those mothers with "this is my cup," so I'm sure there were times
mm-hmm.
when she was could be stifling
mm-hmm.
to him,
yeah.
but always with the idea of keeping it positive. But again, she doesn't really understand his view of the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But, yes, he has a lot. He has a lot on his shoulders, a
yeah.
strong mother. And yet these dreams that are totally opposite to the way she sees the world.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
she controls this opportunity. She
mm-hmm.
is a decision maker mm-hmm. about this opportunity, this money, what will be done with it.
Mhm. Yeah, but she's
and that's kind of universal. The families, I think that's part of the appeal, that a lot of people in families can relate to that. You know, whatever pathway they're on, they can relate to those family themes, the love, the closeness, and yet the tension and the lack of understanding that can be there at the same time in a family.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very much a family story.
Yeah, yeah, and you know, and you know, and your character is looking at the future. You know, if the family has a house, they don't have to worry about.
Yes.
They don't have to worry about a place to stay. That's important.
Right.
You know, having
it is.
A house with a little garden. You know,
right.
she's got this flower that she's been, you know, sort of nurturing.
Right. She has this one plant
mm-hmm.
that she's been nurturing, and if they get this house, she can finally have a chance to have a little. But she calls it a little patch of dirt. Where maybe I can grow me a few flowers.
Right, right, yeah, yeah. And, you know, they're on the south side, and they're looking, you know, not that they don't want to live on the south side, but there's more, you know, they can't find what they want there. They want
right.
a better community, a better neighborhood. And so if that means they have to move across town, then so be it. And she
right.
found this nice house that they can afford. And then what happens with that? You know, it's like the neighborhood, you know, in the guise of their representative says, no, we don't want you to live here.
Right.
We'll pay you more money to not
right.
live here than
right.
you would have if you moved in.
Right.
And
pay
then that's
them.
Another dilemma.
Right. And,
and
it seems like they're paying them to say, they are paying them to say they're not worth living,
right.
as Lena says, not worth being on the earth.
Right, right,
and
yeah.
then she just cannot, she will not, you know. That's, it's just something that is impossible for her to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because, you know, she's got that memory, you know, the Sankofa, you know, she doesn't have to turn her head back too far to be in
right.
enslavement.
Oh,
and
absolutely.
And to see Jim Crow.
Absolutely.
And they're living in a time of, you know, segregation, even
right.
though, quote, you know, they're in the North, like, not really, the North-South.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. So, what are some of your favorite scenes? In the play.
Well, certainly the scene where, as she says, Walter comes into his manhood, and that scene is thrilling. It's thrilling. It gives me chills.
Uh huh.
And the scene where he, you know, his plan to go along with this man who's offering the money, that is just chilling. To see how he expresses what he intends to do, but what gets you about it, what's chilling is you get a chance to see his level of despair, the despair that he is feeling that would drive him to this decision to go along with that. And Todd Risby, the actor, is just wonderful, and that scene just chills me. It just, you know, it just frightens me. But there's that glorious scene where, you know, he sees the world and sees it there and realizes in a moment when he sees his son, the next generation, that he cannot do that. He just can't do that. And when he says that, and that is just, I think, you know, there are moments where we're overcome as cast members. and that's certainly one of them for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, wow. I was thinking, as you were saying that, the themes of you know, trust and forgiveness
uh-huh.
are also, you know, quite visible in the interactions between the your character, Lena, and her son, Walter Lee.
Right.
And between Walter Lee
and
Ruth.
And Ruth.
Walter Lee and Benita,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
to a certain degree.
Right,
and,
because Benita is impatient. You know, she is just quick to dismiss him as, you know, well, not even worth bothering with. And then when she realizes, you know, and feels her love for him and her pride in him when he makes the decision that he's not going to go down this devastating path,
mm-hmm.
that is really a wonderful, that's one of the high points of the story, I think.
Yeah.
When Benita, as young as she is, realizes how much she loves him and then where he is and how positive that is.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a glow, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was just thinking also about what your character says to Benita about black manhood.
Mm-hmm.
And how, you know, the brothers have taken a real serious hit, and they keep on taking hits, and they don't need to take hits in the family. And I'm paraphrasing this not completely.
Right.
But,
but you're doing a wonderful job, because that's the gist of what she's saying. It's easy to dismiss, but the love and understanding comes not when everything is going well, but when he's down and in despair. That's when he needs love. That's when he needs understanding. And she says, you don't measure. When you start judging somebody, child, take everything into consideration. Don't just take what they've done right here that you don't agree with. You've got to take everything into consideration. And she calls it the hills and valleys that he has come through. And that she's giving Benita that wisdom, you know, I know it would be easy for you to dismiss him, but you can't do that. If you're going to measure him and judge him, start at the beginning. Start understanding what he's been through to make him feel and do what he's doing now. And Benita realizes that, and she understands that. And that's a wonderful, wonderful moment.
It really is. It really is. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's a really, really beautiful story, and the reason why it's performed all around the world.
Uh huh.
I mean, it's been translated into so many different languages. It's just amazing, because it's, you know, it's about a family.
Right.
And
right.
Everybody's got a family.
Right.
And, you know, you don't have to be in Chicago. You know, you don't have to be in
right.
San Francisco.
Right,
it's,
right
it's,
here.
Yeah, but it's like, you know, it's a family, and it's looking at, you know, sort of what was the sacrifice? What was the great sacrifice in our lives so that we could be here together right now in this moment,
right.
trying to
right.
figure out how do we cash in on this legacy in a way that furthers the vision of the one who,
right.
who sacrificed their life.
Right. Right.
For this,
right,
you know, it wasn't easy for, you know, Walter Lee Sr. to get up every day and go to
no.
work. You know, I mean,
no.
it was like, it didn't sound really pleasant. You know, he died from a heart attack. I think his heart just stopped because it was just so, I mean, it just was,
mm-hmm.
just took so much out of him.
Right.
You know, I mean, his family wasn't enough. It wasn't to be able to offset this battle
right.
that he was waging every
right.
day on the work. You know, in the workplace.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and you think about that today. I mean, gosh, the few people that have positions, right?
Right, exactly.
And you mentioned that you got a day job yourself.
Right.
So you can't feed yourself with what you love, with your
Absolutely.
Passion. So it's like,
Absolutely.
Okay, so how do I save enough of myself to be able to do what I love?
Right, exactly.
And to be present with those that I love. How do I shake off the world so that I can be here with you, you know, my
right.
beloved family, my beloved children, you know, my sisters and my brothers and my mother and my friends, and then get what you need there to be able to go out again, because it's really, you know, it's not getting any easier outside.
No, no, no. And it takes a lot, and you have to have that core. You preserve that core, that nurturing core of the family.
Yeah, yeah. Family is really important. People don't seem to value it as much as it's been valued before. Is that why African American Shakespeare Company is doing Raising the Sun? Because sort of the whole idea of honoring and lifting up the black family?
Honoring and lifting and preserving and understanding the strength of the foundation which buoys you to go forward.
Uh-huh.
You know, we have a strong, strong foundation. And I think this presentation will refresh that. Will refresh that understanding of the black foundation and the family foundation, whatever pathway you're on.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. So have you had your school time performance yet? Because I know you all do something every
yes, we
season.
Did. We had it day before yesterday, and
oh,
it was
super
wonderful. And the young people really, they had been assigned to read the play, and they really liked it. And they said we read it and we liked the production, and they asked wonderful questions about it, very thoughtful questions about it. And so that was really a pleasure. That was a joy to have them be there and to feel their, you know, their response to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How old were the children?
I think they were middle school, maybe a little older.
Okay.
Some middle school and maybe freshman in high school.
Okay. Oh, nice range. And I was just thinking how interesting it is that there are two Lorraine Hansberry plays being produced and performed in San Francisco at the same time. Yours at the African American Shakespeare Company, Raising in the Sun, and To Be Young, Gifted, and Black at the ethnic multi-ethnic theater. On golf in San Francisco. Yeah, so I think
and
that's really cool.
It's her time. It's in celebration of her birthday, too, you mentioned.
Oh,
right?
Yeah, totally. Yeah, her birthday's, you know, the 19th of May. And I didn't even know that. Because, you know, people think Malcolm X. I'm like, Lorraine Hansberry. And I saw when I said, Lorraine Hansberry's birthday is the 19th as well. And I'm like, ooh, you go, sister.
Right.
Yeah, wow, some great folks born on that day.
Right.
Yeah, well, thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
For this
thank you, thank you, thank
really
you. It was our pleasure. It was our pleasure.
Yeah, and looking forward to seeing you. I'm going away for Mother's Day weekend, so I won't be around for opening night on the 12th when the play opens, but I definitely will catch it the following week.
Wonderful.
And looking forward to seeing what you all do with one of my favorite works. I remember going to a symposium. Dr. Margaret Wilkerson, who was at UC Berkeley at the time, she's a Lorraine Hansberry scholar.
Oh,
And they were doing a symposium on her work, and I think the play was being produced by Theater Works in Mountain View.
Uh-huh.
And Dr. Harry Elam, he had pulled together this great panel when it was at UC Berkeley, and they were talking about everything you wanted to know about Lorraine Hansberry. And, of course, you know, they talked about this seminal piece, you know,
right.
The Sun,
right.
Because you know, she's so well known for this. But she's done, you know, quite a few plays.
Right,
and,
for sure.
And after she passed, you know, her, you know, the executors of her estate, thank you, have done a really good job in keeping her work alive and
absolutely.
Allowing people to have access to it. And then, you know, having the Lorraine Hansberry Theater, you know, in San
Francisco.
Right. So every time we think the theater, we call her name.
Right. Isn't that cool?
Yeah, it's really cool. Yeah, and, you know, they're closing their season with another wonderful writer, Pearl Cleage, you know, her work, Blues for Alabama Sky. Did you get a chance to get over there, or have you been in rehearsals the whole time?
I've been in rehearsals pretty much.
Yeah. So I also wanted to give you an opportunity to give a shout-out to your mom. And are you a mother yourself?
Yes, I am, for sure.
Okay, nice. Nice. So you can give a shout-out to your mom and your great-grand, and then also a shout-out to yourself, you know, for being a wonderful mother.
Well, to happy Mother's Day to all mothers, And it's a special day, and enjoy the specialness of the day. It's our day, so
yeah.
I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, do you want to tell us your mother's name and maybe, you know,
well,
reflect on
mother,
any lessons that, you know, that she,
my
you know,
mother was
gave
Helen.
You? Oh, for
my
real?
Mother was Helen, who passed away when I was an infant. Mm-hmm. And I was raised by a grandmother, Eleanor. My grandmother raised me.
And you're
named
after her.
And I'm named after her. And my dad. My dad and his mom, my grandmother Eleanor, raised my sister and I. And so I honor my mother, and I also honor my grandmother on that day. And my grandmother has passed away. She passed away in 1970.
Okay, yeah.
So, and then I'm a mother. I have one son. And so I just enjoy Mother's Day, and I love the specialness of it. I love to see that day highlighted and the mothers highlighted.
Mm-hmm.
So best wishes to all mothers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you, and well, happy Mother's Day to you. And I was going to, in closing, again, I think we've been in closing for a minute, but does you know, when you sort of take on this role of Lena, younger, are you pulling on your relationship with your son?
Oh, absolutely. And my relationship with my grandmother.
Okay.
And how she was, you know. So those are the two themes that just stay with me during this process.
Uh-huh.
My grandmother and, of course, my son.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what values or, you know, what lessons of your grandmother's do you carry with you now that you tap into often?
Well, she, her strength and how she went through a lot of things. And as I say, I'm a woman of a certain age, as they say, and I've gone through life and lived some things that were wonderful and did some things that were not so wonderful. My husband went through a long illness. Gravely ill for a long time. And so I remember how my grandmother was always there and came through, and I remember some of the things that she had to endure. And so it's her strength that comes to me. And also her, and the beneath the character makes me chuckle sometimes, because my grandmother used to say that I was the sassiest child she ever raised.
How many did she raise?
And she raised 8.
Oh, wow, okay.
And she's the fastest child I ever raised. And then when she was dying, she said to me, you know, baby, I loved you better than any of them. She said, you were most like me than any of them. Mm-hmm. So that made me know that the tension that we had, because we did have some knockdown, drag-out bouts of tension, me and my grandmother.
Mm-hmm.
But that just meant so much to me that she said that to me. And so when I see Benita, you know, and she's sassy and she knows her own mind and she, you know, I just have to chuckle because it brings back some of those memories where I was going to, no, see, Gran, you don't understand. This is the way, you know, and I say to myself, so that's how I was.
Yeah, nice. Oh, that's great. Wow. Well, have a wonderful opening night.
Thank you.
Saturday, May 12th, and have a wonderful Mother's Day weekend. It's great to be opening up a new show, and you have a performance on Mother's Day, so that's going to be really special.
Right, it is.
Yeah, matinee performance. Is it at 2 or 3?
It's at 3.
3 o'clock, yeah.
Same location.
762 Fulton in the Burial Clay.
Right.
Well, cool. Well, you take good care, and
right.
Looking forward to seeing you the week after this.
Okay. All right. And thank you, Wanda.
Oh, you're welcome. It's been really, really, really special talking to you this morning.
Thank you.
All right. Peace and love.
Bye.
Well, we are speaking to Ms. Eleanor Jacobs, who is performing the role of Lena Younger in the African American Shakespeare Company's production of Raisin in the Sun by Lorraine Hansberry. And we are going to close out with another one of these Sweet Honey in the Rock tunes. Let's see, which one haven't I played? I think I played them all. So I think we're going to play Motherless Child. Oh, no, actually, I think I'll play Battered Earth. I'm not sure what that one sounds like, but it sounds pretty apropos because, you know, we have our Mother Earth to thank for sustaining our lives. So let's listen to this one. And it's from, as I mentioned, Sweet Honey and the Rock's 25th anniversary release.
If the earth could fly away, could you see her flying straight through space and time, leaving all humankind behind? If she could fly away, if she could fly away, so far away. If the earth could run away, could you see her gathering all the trees and plants, all the animals, all the birds and fowl, every creeping thing? They have never been her foe, never harmed her blessed soul. If she could run away, if she could run away, so far away, then she'd be running for life. Oh, she'd be running for life, running for her life. Oh, she'd be running for life. Oh, she'd be running for life, running for her blessed life. If the earth could up and walk away, could you see her causing home all the oceans and the seas, all the rivers and the streams, all the whales and fish, every reptile that exists? They have never been her foe, never harmed her blessed soul. If she could walk away, if she could walk away, so far away, then she'd be running for life. Oh, she'd be running for life, running for her blessed life. Oh, she'd be running for life. Oh, she'd be running for life, running for her blessed life. If the earth could crawl away, could you see her moving on with her body withered down? She'd be struggling to be free, free from cruel humanity. She could fall away, if she could get away, so far away. Then she'd be struggling for life. Oh, she'd be struggling for life, struggling for life.